Hey, welcome to a special edition of Leave the Ring Radio. I got Fight Hubs, the founder, creator of Fight Hub, Marcos Villegas. How you doing, brother?
I'm good, man. Just glad it's a sunny day here in Southern California. We had a few days of rain. I'm doing good. I'm doing as good as you could do during this self-imposed quarantine.
So how are you coping with it, man? First off, before we get into the stack-up show, and we'll kind of give the description what the show is going to be about. But, you know, how are you holding up? What are you doing to occupy yourself? Are you playing like – because most folks that I'm talking to, and even myself, I'm not a big gamer, but I'm starting to become a big, big gamer now because everybody's in quarantine or self-shelter.
What are you playing?
I try to play like Call of Duty or the Fight Night Champion, the latest one that they have, right? I found out I'm not very good at it. And then when I get on the Call of Duty, I'm doing all right until my kids jump on and then they kind of show out and kind of, I'm not that good.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing the same thing. I've been playing a lot of video games, to be honest. You know, I have all these games that, because I'm so busy with work, I never get a chance to play.
Right.
So I've been catching up on video games. I haven't watched one fight since all this has started.
Really?
I know everybody's been like showing like all the old fights. Yeah, right. I haven't watched. That's a lie. I watched Vasquez Marquez 3. I watched that when they replayed it, and I watched Castillo Corrales. But outside of those two, I haven't watched any boxing. I've just been playing video games, been working, been running, been going outside away from people because where I live, there's a lot of trails. So I make sure to stay away from people. And when I see too many people, I go a different way, or I just go back inside, or I go in a different area. So that's kind of how I've been dealing with all this, like going outside and running and going on hikes, especially when I'm feeling a little down or like a little stir crazy.
Right.
Really, really helps, like, big time.
You know, I don't know about you, but my sleep schedule is so, so off right now. You know,
like, oh, my sleep schedule is horrible.
Yeah, man.
I'm going to bed really late, yep. Waking up really late too.
Yeah, man. I kind of find myself the way, you know, that Narcos series, the very first one where Pablo Escobar is just kind of like sitting at the bench or looking at the ocean.
Thinking about his brother,
right?
Yeah, yeah, the memes. Yeah. No, same way, man. And like, I live by myself, you know, so it's like a little worse because, like, I'm just here. I can't see any of my friends, and sometimes I'll call them, and
right.
I don't talk to a lot of people as it is normally, to be honest, you know. But I've been video chatting a little bit more, and that's helped. But man, for those people that are in with like their families and stuff,
yeah,
consider it a blessing, man.
Right?
Because like when you live by yourself, you don't got anyone to talk to. At least you got family members to talk to, you know.
No pets, bro. No cats, no dogs. Now that's
no. I wish I had pets, man. My landlord won't allow us to have dogs. We're allowed to have cats, but I've been very hesitant about getting a pet because I'm gone so much when I work that I think it. Last thing I want to be is an irresponsible pet owner, you know.
Exactly.
And I don't want to do that, you know. So
yeah,
that's why I choose not to have a pet right now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I got my kids, both my grown kids, they're in college, but they're, since there's no school, they're in the house, you know. And then I got my two little fur babies, and I got the wife. So you know, even though I got somebody to talk to, there are a lot of downtime for me because of the sleep, you know, like the sleep schedule. You know, I wake up, everybody's in bed, and then when I'm asleep, everybody gets up. So I'm almost like living by myself in some ways or not. But good thing, man, that we got this outlet here still. Even though there's no boxing and there's no actual sports being played, at least we have the opportunity with the internet to still be social. Having that social distance that they're asking for that we need right now in this time, at least we can still interact with each other, right?
Yeah, no, we can, but sometimes that social media gets a little too much too, man. I've noticed people have stopped like logging in as much the last week, and I think it's I don't know, like they just get over it. It's overwhelming for people, and like a lot of people have said like, it's too much. Like I just need to like do something else.
It can cause a lot of anxiety. Going on. To tell you the truth,
what's up?
You know, I mean, the social media, it's toxic sometimes. It could cause anxiety.
Yeah, that's true. It can, especially when people are posting about like what's going on and stuff right. like that. I could see people like, nah, I don't want to hear about how bad it is anymore. But like, you know, what I tell my friends is like, bro, like this reality, like you can't hide from reality. Like this is what's happening. Like you got to be aware of what's happening and you got to go and adapt to it. You know, you just can't hide from the fact that this thing's going on.
Exactly.
You know, you can't hide from reality. No, you know, you got to face reality. This is what's happening.
You got to face it and also got to understand the information that's being put out there, you know, you know, not go blind out to the world where, you know, you may miss something that's going to be crucial, not just to your life, but to everybody else that's around you. Right.
No, for sure, man, for sure. You know, definitely there's been a lot of disinformation like
right.
put out there like about this. And even like I remember like even in the beginning, you know, a lot of people weren't taking it serious.
Yeah.
And they were putting out stuff like, oh, you know, the flu kills more people. This thing's killed more people than the flu now.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and in the span of 2 months, let's think about that.
Yeah.
You know, where the flu is like a 6 month period. Time and this thing is just, you know, taking out people in 2 months.
And then that's really, really pissed me off when I started seeing it, because I saw a lot of boxing people post stuff like that, you know, and it got me really, really angry because I had a friend who's a doctor from Australia.
Uh-huh.
And because at first I was like in the middle, like I knew it was bad. I trusted what was coming out from the media because, you know, we right. work in media. You could tell when something's bullshit or not. You could always fact check it.
Right.
You know, so a lot of the stuff I was seeing like, hey, no, this is really happening, you know. But I didn't think – I was thinking, well, I'm young. If I get it, I'll be fine. And then I spoke to my friend from Australia who was telling me like, dude, there's a big amount of young people that are getting it. And, yes, yeah, some of them are getting better.
Right.
But some of them are in the ICU because they have – pre-existing conditions that they never knew about. You know, if you had pneumonia before as a kid, if you had asthma as a kid, this is going to hit you even more.
Right.
You know, I had pneumonia when I was young, you know, it's like, yeah, your lungs probably have scar tissue. It's probably going to hit you harder than a normal person.
Right.
It could, you know? So after I had that conversation with her, this was when I was in Washington, D.C., because we had a Fox show scheduled.
Mm-hmm.
We got there on Thursday. I spoke to her on Thursday. And Fox had asked us, sorry, that's the alarm to be here on the podcast.
No, go ahead.
Fox had asked us to leave. And I was thinking, maybe I should stay, like, you know, free hotel. Like, maybe I should stay an extra day just to kind of see DC.
Right.
And after I talked to her, I was like, nah, I'm getting the hell out of here, man. Like, I'm going back home.
You know, what's crazy is that when folks are saying, you know, it doesn't attack you if you're fully healthy. But here's the thing is, as Americans, you know, a lot of us consume a lot of stuff that's not even healthy for us. I mean,
bro,
think about
here's the thing.
Go ahead.
You know what? That's a great point. We're not healthy. Americans are the least healthiest out of everyone around the world.
And how many Americans go to checkups? Let's think about that.
Yeah.
So how do you really know if you're really that healthy?
You don't.
Exactly.
You don't. We eat crap food. We don't exercise. We drink way too much. All the food that we have has stuff that we don't know about. You know, like, we're not a very healthy population as a whole, Americans, you know?
No. You know, we're on the bottom pole of when it comes to health, you know, being healthy, and also when it comes to education. You know, a lot of us jump the gun. Most Americans just read the headlines before they read the body of content that's being put out there. You know, you know that, you know, you've been in working media for years. You know, you put a title over your video or your interview and it's just the lead in. It's not necessarily what the whole interview is going to be about and how many people jump down your neck, you know, without even actually even listening to the interview. Right.
Yeah, I get that a lot on like the comment section. I always have to tell them like, bro, listen to the full interview, you know, like always like. All you did was just read the headline and commented, like, listen to the video. Right. Yeah, no, I feel you on that.
So let me ask you this. When did you know you had something with Fight Hub? You know, because this is the first time I've ever spoken to you. So I'm kind of curious. When was it that first video where you said, dude, I got something. I can do something with this.
Yeah, you know, I think I was very fortunate that when I started doing Fight Hub, it was still very early on in YouTube.
Right.
So it's a lot different now for people. The first video that I did ended up getting like a good amount of views. I think it got like 30,000 views. But I still didn't think like I had something there. I just thought like, well, that was a funny video. It was random. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy that I did the video with had a good following at the time. Maybe it was his followers that, you know, went ahead and did it. I did a few more interviews and did it all right, you know. And then I did a video with Bob Sapp that ended up getting 1 million views 3 weeks later.
Wow.
So within a month of posting these videos on YouTube, that had happened, the first video and then that Bob Sapp video that did like 1 million views. And that's, I hadn't even named it Fight Hub yet. It was just still like my personal channel. Luckily, YouTube allowed us to change the name of it. So I changed it to Fight Hub. But
right.
It was at that point where I was like, hey, this isn't normal. Like, people don't normally get 1 million views like a month into doing this. And that's when I thought like, hey, maybe I could do something with this. Like, maybe there's something here. So yeah, very, very early on, a month into it, back in 2009.
Okay. So let me ask you what, cause you know what, the reason I got into YouTube back in 2008 was because I had no outlet over here. I was born and raised in San Jose, which is now away from San Francisco. And San Jose, you would know this. It's like the mecca of MMA, you know, everybody.
Yeah, Tachi there. Palace, a lot of stuff. I went to those Tachi Palace fights.
Yeah. You know, so I was a guy that rarely ever spoke to anybody about the sport that I love. And my sister, the one that brought a computer, because I was still kind of living in the caveman years. And she was like, check these guys out. And I remember watching a few videos of the very first YouTube guys that were talking boxing. And I was like, what are these guys talking about? And that's what sucked me in. You know, that's when I started doing videos. And the same thing like you, I was like, oh, I'm not really sure what it's going with. And I actually just kind of did it kind of like as a goof for a minute. But then like in that same year, Jack Mosley contacted me. And they were like, hey, we'd like you to come down and do an interview to interview us. And I was like, I'm not media, you know, I'm just a blue collar guy, you know, that's all I do. So I went down there, started that. And then it just kind of steamrolled after that. So what got you involved?
I was also doing work for an MMA company, doing marketing. So they already had me going to the gyms and getting content to promote like their fights with their fighters. And just so happened, a lot of those guys were, because I started doing MMA first before boxing. Boxing came as a natural progression. As I got credibility, like in MMA with the channel, I started reaching out to boxers and I transitioned over there to boxing. I'd always liked boxing, but just so happened, I was doing work for an MMA company and I was already getting content for them. And a lot of the content they didn't want to use, so I would post it up.
Hmm.
So it was a natural progression, you know. People started seeing like, hey, you're doing interviews. And then I thought, well, if I'm doing this with MMA, I like boxing just as much as MMA. Why don't I try to go to these boxing gyms and reach out and, you know, get content? Because at the time, there wasn't a lot of people doing it. And I thought, hey, you know, this would be a good way to bring another audience into the channel. It is called Fight Hub. You know, there's more than one fight sport, you know. So, yeah, that's how it happened with boxing. And I don't remember what my first boxing event was. I remember the first boxing fight I got credentialed to. But I think the first boxing event I went to, I think it had to have been a press conference with Chris Areola and Tom Adam. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think after that, that was the first boxing fight I got credentialed was Areola versus Adamek. And then from there, that's how me covering boxing started.
I was at that one too. Wow.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I was at. You know what's funny is that I think Goosen too, I remember Craig Goosen was like one of the very first to kind of see that there was something there with YouTubers, you know, because Golden Boy, I remember when I was trying to press with them of getting credentials and showing them like the videos and how many hits I were getting, they kind of looked at and they're like, like we don't know what that is. Golden Boy
would not credential me at the beginning. No one credentialed me but them.
Yeah.
But Goosen Tudor and Thompson Boxing. Those were the only two that would credential me.
Yeah, man. That's kind of strange. But here we are. You know, they all thought it was kind of like a fab and it was gonna just disappear and fizzle out. But
no.
you know. Anyways, man,
yeah, it was crazy. I remember that fight, that Adamic fight. I was like in the back row, and I remember I had a press member from Poland right next to me, and I thought it was the funniest thing. And I'm not like a PC guy at all, you know. But I was like, dude, this guy's going to get his ass kicked if he keeps yelling this. So, like, during the fight, he kept yelling. And I don't know if you heard him, but he was loud. He kept yelling, hit that fat burrito, hit that fat burrito. And I was like, dude, this guy is going to get decked. Like, does this guy not understand? There's nothing but Mexicans here. Like,
yeah.
Someone punch this guy. But it was the funniest thing because I'm like, dude, you're supposed to be a press guy. And he's like, cheering for Adamic and hit that burrito, and I was just like, man, this guy's nuts.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, I remember yeah. how electric it was there. I had a chance to interview everybody, you know, after and all that, but now I don't remember.
Dude, I'm surprised there's that many Polish people there in Southern California, right? There was a lot of Polish fans.
There was a lot.
Where'd they come from?
I don't know.
I've never seen that many Polish people in Southern California ever.
And they were talking a lot of shit.
Yeah, they were.
They were talking a lot of shit, but it was great.
Yeah, they were.
You know, it was a phenomenal experience. You know, I stopped covering events, though, to tell you the truth. I just really stuck with the whole podcasting. I just started doing that. I honestly, I'll tell you what happened with me was I got tired of the boxing politics, the good old boy club stuff.
Yeah. No, it's still there, bro. It's still there. It's still... You would think, you know, someone like me who is with the network now wouldn't have to put up with as much of that, and I still have to, man. It's right. It's still hard at times, man. I still got to fight to get interviews, to get stuff, to get, you know, I think given the size of my outlet,
right,
we still get looked down upon because we're digital. You know, we don't get the same preferred access still as print mostly print, to be honest, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, it's still happening, man.
Yeah. I still see it. I see it out there all the time. You know, I don't engage as much as I used to, but I do. I still witness it. So let me get down and tell everybody what the show's about. It's called The Stack Up Show. And I'm not a fantasy fight kind of guy. Never have been.
Yeah.
But how times are right now, we're all on lockdown, and pretty much all I've been able to do, like the rest of the world, is go back and look at old fights. So I figured, why not bring one of the OGs, yourself, Marcos, with me, and we would do fantasy fights. So see how the older guys would stack up to the guys that are current, of today. And I picked two names that I picked that I thought were kind of interesting. Costa Zoo and Marcos Antonio Barreras. Both guys I was a huge fans of, grew up watching them, and I still think to this day that they stack up pretty well to some of the current champions or current, you know, contenders in the division.
No, definitely they do, man. So I like this, but sometimes it's hard.
Right.
I think with certain fighters, because we hold them at such high reverence that I think sometimes it clouds our judgment to the reality of athletes now are better than what they were before. But I think in the case, and you put it correctly, in the case of Costa Zoo and Barrera, I think they would still do very, very well today because they were both very fundamentally balanced.
Right.
Both very, very good. Good. Costa Zoo had that power that would have set him apart from a lot of people. Now, and it set him apart back then. So, yeah, man, let's do this. I'm excited.
Okay, so let's go with the first one. Now, I wanted to go with Costa Zoo because there's some stuff that you touched on that I was going to talk about. One, that Costa Zoo, if you really look at some of the European fighters, they still are very mold the way Costa Zoo was because that was kind of a traditional style of what they grew up with, you know, like the Kaliskos. Very 1-2, stand upright, look for the big punch, not waste a whole lot of punches. You know, and really start everything off with a jab. So I still believe Costa Zoo would either be a titleist or be a unified champion. But then when you look at who he's lost, to Vernon Phillips and then to Han later down the line in his lane of his career, I think, honestly, I think he kind of gave that fight away with Hatton. just because I think he wanted to pass the, you know, pass the guard along and stuff. I don't think he wanted to be part of the sport. That's my theory. That's my hope. You know what I mean? Because I was so, oh, bro, I was brokenhearted when he lost to Ricky. I was like, oh, shit. But I think Josh Taylor, if we look at the styles here, Josh Taylor, in my opinion, who's got 16 wins and 12 KOs, right? His footwork, hand speed, the overall IQ that I've seen so far from him, I don't know about you, Marcus, but I think he gives Costazu a lot of problems.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with that. I think the world is starting to see how good Josh Taylor is. I remember when I first saw him, I want to say maybe 2 years ago, my first reaction was, holy shit, this kid is really good. You know, right. Really, really good, solid fundamentals. Really, really good speed. You know, the speed would have been a problem for Costazu, though he did fight speed fighters, you know, in his career. And he would always be able to, you know what Costazu had? Really good timing, you know? And that's the thing that they say about beating a speed fighter. You know, speed, timing beats speed, you know? So you got to think, if there was a fight, maybe Josh Taylor would have pulled ahead on the cards, and it would have been something where Costazu would have been hunting, would have been pressuring, timing, and just waiting for that one big shot. And that's the thing, you know, has Taylor ever taken a punch? The power of someone like Costazu, you would think, you know, Regis Prograis is a big puncher, right? But not like Costazu, you know, he had way different power. Even the way he would throw his punches were different, you know. It's just a different technique of throwing them. So, you know, it'd be interesting. I would think, you know, it would be something where he would be behind on the cards and he'd have to trail back and have to do something dramatic. But, you know, it's always hard when you have a guy like that, I don't want to say he's plotting, but the way his feet are set because he's a power guy. And because his feet are set like that, they're not as fast moving around the ring. And you got to think Taylor would have used his speed to move around the ring and just try to outbox Costazu in a potential fight.
I agree with that. You know, the thing with Taylor, he's not Zab Judah. Zab Judah had speed, but his speed was in spurts. It wasn't consistent. You know, like he always needed to like re-gear himself in order to let his hands go again. What Costa is that consistent pressure. And the one thing that I've always admired about Costazu is that you always knew that he was going to throw that right hand no matter what. He'd measure you with that left hook, that left hand, that left jab, and then he would find that time and that range just to throw it down that pipe and hit you. You know, he didn't have a whole lot to his arsenal. He only had those three punches, but man, he was good at it. You know, he was really good at applying pressure, and he was really good at throwing those punches when he needed to throw them.
Yeah, and who's to say, too, that the pressure wouldn't have bothered Taylor where, you know, Costazu would have been able to cut the ring off and trap Josh in the corner or in a preferable distance where he could time those punches where he could, you know, throw the jab, flick the jab to the body, flick the jab to the top, and follow it up with the right hand. You know, Costazu was tremendous at that. And that's the other thing with when you fight a fighter that is a mover or has a lot of speed, you know, there's a few ways to go around it. You know, obviously one of them is to pressure them, not allow them to move and cut the ring off. It's a lot harder for the pressure fighters now to do that.
Yeah.
Because these guys are very conditioned. And I think, you know, you're having to eat a lot of punches on your way in because a lot of the pressure fighters now don't move their waist or don't pressure with the jab coming forward, you know, which would cause the other opponent to not throw as much.
Okay, so we're back here. Sorry about that if we fell off for a short bit, but we're back on. I would have to agree with you. I think that Costazu could edge, even possibly get that late stoppage. But God, I like Josh Taylor a whole lot. You know, I think that right now he's the it factor. He's the man to beat in that division at 140, you know. I agree with D-Style, who just put it up a comment saying I don't think Josh Taylor is strong enough to even hold back a Costa-Zoo. I don't think so either. We haven't really seen him have to do that.
That's a good point, man. That's a very, very good point. You know, and it all comes back down to what we were saying about pressure. You know, it's like I've always said for the longest time, if I was a fighter at welterweight, I would hate to fight Sean Porter because of the pressure. Because that's a long night, a lot of work, and he's going to make you work. And yeah. when you face a pressure fighter, it's not only physically taxing, man. It's mentally taxing too,
yes,
dude.
It is.
Like you're in there and you're just like, you have to be focused at all times. You don't really get a moment to breathe or catch your breath. This guy's on you. You know, you're throwing your best punches and the guy keeps coming. And then now you're having to fight like mental emotions. Like, dude, like I just hit this guy with like a bunch of punches and he's still coming forward. Like, what the heck, you know?
Exactly.
It's very, very draining overall to fight a really well-conditioned pressure fighter. Now, imagine if it's one who's stronger than you, who's used to fighting bigger guys, and packs a bigger, way bigger punch than you. It can end up being overwhelming, and it's not surprising how, you know, a lot of these guys end up drowning people in the later rounds. But this is the thing. We don't see a lot of great pressure fighters now, to be honest. You know, who's a great pressure fighter right now? Like, it's hard to list. Like, the last great pressure fighter to me was Margarito. The last great pressure where he came forward, threw a lot of punches, and was on you, did not let you breathe. I haven't seen a guy like that lately.
No, I think everybody right now is more into trying to mold themselves into a three-headed type of fighter, you know, pressure, be elusive, and be the best fighter they can possibly, you know, and I don't think that works. I think with Antonio Margarito, he understood who he was and what he could do in the ring, so he stuck with that, just like Costa-Zoo. You didn't see Costa try to be the most elusive guy. He didn't try to be like a Pernell Whitaker. He wasn't the fastest person, but he stuck to what he knew, and he perfected what he had. And that's what, in my opinion, made him a great fighter. Now, the other guy that's in 140 division right now, you got Jose Ramirez out of Fresno, California. 25 wins, 17 KOs. I think that's a completely different fight. But I think, Marcos, in my opinion, I think that is the most winnable fight for Costa-Zoo because that's the kind of guy he would want to face, somebody to come forward. He had a lot of great success with some Mexican fighters and champions in his time, right?
No, he did. That would have been a fight of the year type of fight, probably round of the year. It would have been a great fight for as long as it would have lasted because, you know, Jose. Jose likes to brawl, dude. He likes to
mix it up. Yeah.
Yeah, he likes to bring it. And that Costa-Zoo would do the same thing. So I think, you know, with there, I don't think Ramirez would have had quite the punch to maybe back Costa-Zoo and gain his respect in terms of being weary about which punches to throw and when to throw and how many punches to throw. I think the power would have made the difference there for Costa-Zoo as well as the technique there. I would have favored Costa-Zoo in that fight because that's his style. And he's a lot better at that style than I think Ramirez is at this point, though, you know, Ramirez is getting better. But I think, you know, we've seen that the power is just not quite there in comparison to Costa-Zoo when you match those two guys up.
You know, I don't think there's denying, though, that what we've seen from Jose Ramirez of late, I've seen him being with the Garcias now, I think it's helped him out a lot. I see him sitting on the punches a lot more. He seems to be a bit more heavy-handed. I didn't think he was going to stop Maurice Hooker. I thought that Maurice was going to really get I thought it was going to go the distance, to tell you the truth. I just thought it was going to be a brutal, and maybe there'll be a TKO based on cuts and bruises. But the way Jose Ramirez came out, I mean, man, he's impressed me every single time since being with Robert Garcia.
No, you know, he's improved big time. He's gotten a lot better. And yeah, the power is starting to develop a little bit more. But, you know, Costa-Zoo is just a born puncher, man. Like, you can improve things to get more power out of people. But at the end of the day, like, that old adage, like, you know, punchers aren't made, they're born. It's true. Some guys are just naturally, like, heavy-handed. Their body mechanics they're just different. Their muscles and tendons are connected just differently, where they're able to leverage more of their weight and get power behind them. You know, there's some guys that you could do everything in the world, strength training,
right,
the highest tech type training, and they're never going to be big, powerful punchers. You know, you could sit on your punches and get more leverage, but at the end of the day, if you don't have that God-given power, like you can't turn a guy who doesn't have that much power into a murderous puncher. It just doesn't work that way.
Now, Regis Progress is a bull, and obviously Josh Taylor kind of showed what he could do with a bull. But I still say this is a very interesting fight for Costa Zoo. Costa Zoo was overwhelmed by Ricky Hatton, a mauler style. Could Regis do the exact same thing Ricky Hatton was successful with against Costa Zoo, Marcus?
Well, it all depends. You know, obviously, that was later in the career of Costa
right.
Zoo. Ricky Hatton was just a buzzsaw, man. This guy never would get tired, relentless, another pressure guy, you know, that would just go to the body, would wrestle a lot, do a lot of pummeling to get you tired. And you know, I come from a wrestling background, an MMA background, mm-hmm. in terms of, like, I trained all that all my life. So when you're pummeling on the inside, it gets you tired. Like, that's a whole different type of conditioning that you have to do so you don't get tired. Your arms get really heavy, your shoulders get heavy, and that tires you out. And that Ricky liked to work on the inside, liked to pummel, you know, get a glove in there, get a glove out, throw a punch, put that glove back in, throw a punch to the body. That would have been tiresome. Now, with Regis, I don't think Regis throws as much as Hatton, though he's certainly heavy-handed. But I think he's missing the volume there of a Hatton.
I think so, too. I think the body work of a Hatton is what Regis needs
and
to bring,
too.
You know, yeah. needs to bring to that table. You know, I mean, look, I've always said this to fighters. I mean, I'm pretty sure when you have spoken to fighters, a lot of them will tell you, I don't go back and watch old fighters for some reason. There's no interest in there, which I've always found very weird, you know, that they don't go back and look at certain tricks that the old fighters used to bring to the table, you know, because I think that if a lot of them did their homework, you wouldn't really hear a lot of folks saying that the teaching in boxing is becoming extinct, because fighters would be able to pick this up with their own eyes and see that. Because I've worked with kids that you could talk to them until you're blue to the face, but until you show them that it works, that's when they get that aha moment, like, oh, now I know what you're talking about, now I know what you mean, you know. And I think that's why we see the lost art of a pressure fighter, like you were mentioning earlier, you know, because I've always said, like, Mike Tyson and even the late of Julio Cesar Chavez Sr.'s career had kind of tarnished the way fighters look at having balls out style. They believe that taking a lot of shots to the face and head is the natural way of being the bull in the ring, of coming forward. But they don't look back past, you know, the beginning of these guys' career, where the head movement was there, how Julio Cesar Chavez used to pair a lot, you know, how he used his feet to close that distance to get to the body. Those are the things that is missing. I think Regis can do it, but it would be something that he would have to discipline himself and kind of go back to that drawing board, because he would really need that with Costa Zoo. So I think Costa Zoo, in my opinion, I think he stops him in mid-rounds.
It's hard to unlearn what you have learned already, because it's years and years and years of building that foundation. So it's hard to go and incorporate something completely different and completely new. Because you kind of freak out, you kind of like lose your way in a way when you do that. But I do agree, you know, when you look at Tyson and Chavez, especially Chavez, man, that guy was super defensive, even though he was offensive, because
right.
of what you mentioned, like the head movement, moving the waist, using the glove out there to parry. So, you know, that's the other thing, too. It surprises me when they don't watch old tape. I know trainers do, but like every single, like, the tape is there, like whatever, like, fighter you're going up against, that style has already been there,
right?
And those fighters with that style have been beaten, so the blueprint is in the tapes, in the history of boxing, pressure fighters,
slick fighters, punchers, all those styles have been beaten. You just got to go back through the history of boxing and see how those fighters, why they lost, what these other fighters did to combat that. Like, every single blueprint to beat a fighter is there in video on tapes,
right,
of these fighters that have these fights that have happened in the past. So I've always wondered that too. Like, if I was a trainer and told me, like, hey, you know, you're preparing for this slick style, I'd go and look up slick guys that have lost fights,
right,
and seen those fights and be like, okay, you know, what worked there? And, you know, obviously those fighters are completely different than the fighters that are fighting, you know, but I would say, like, oh, well, this seemed to work here. Why did this work? No, I have this guy. What does this guy do that's similar to that? Okay, let's build onto that, you know?
Yeah, you know, Costa Zoo was a throwback. I remember watching him, and he would do these little subtle things that got him that edge. Like, if he missed with the right hand, he still would clip you the way Roberto Duran used to clip you with the left hook with the elbow. He would skin you a bit, you know? He was one of those very physical guys when he got in close with you. I mean, look at how he dismantled Zab Judah. You know, he made sure that he was on him. He didn't give him that room to breathe. And here's the thing. He actually forced Zab Judah to step backwards, not step aside. He didn't give that. He didn't give you that split second to think. And that's what a lot of pressure fighters don't understand. You know, I'll tell you the last pressure guy that I saw that did a phenomenal job against the up-and-comer that now is considered one of the pound-for-pound fighters of the world, Vasily Lomachenko, is when he got in with Orlando Siri. I mean, Orlando was on him. He never allowed this kid to breathe. He didn't allow him to think. He didn't allow him to use his footwork. He didn't allow him to do the pity pat to find the little kinks in his defense. He made sure that he backed him up. And then when he didn't back them up, he roughed them up all through the rounds.
Yeah, that was a big learning experience for Lomachenko. He roughed him up, man. He mugged him in that fight.
He was hitting
him. Hit him everywhere. It didn't matter where. Hit him in the balls. Hit him in the hips.
Yep.
Hit him in the hips. It didn't matter. But it, you know, he obviously, you know, if that fight were to happen now, it's completely different. Salido, I don't even think Salido, even though he hasn't, did he ever? I don't think he ever announced that he was retired. But he's like a politician now in Mexico.
He's a politician in Mexico, and yeah. He's out of limelight. You know, I see Sean Gibbons. I had him on, I think it was last year, you know. And I remember him, man. He was just like, hey, but we still got that one up on Lomachenko. I was like, yeah, you do.
Yeah, no, they do, you know. But that shows you what when a pressure fighter done right can do with a style like that. And, you know, Chavez versus Roger Mayweather. There's so many examples of how to nullify like a defensive fighter, and it is with smart pressure that's built upon a double jab, I feel. But yeah, no, that I was there live when Lomachenko lost that fight, man.
Ooh.
It's crazy, dude, because you know what the consensus was on Press Row?
What was that?
Was this guy's done. That's it. Like, all this hype and what, you know? That's what a lot of people were thinking. Like, yeah, this guy was overhyped. He couldn't even beat Salido. And, like, the thing is, like, Salido's a guy, like, yeah, he has a journeyman record. But, like, on any given night, Salido could have beaten anybody in the world.
I mean, well, look at his resume.
He's a handful.
Look at his – Robert Guerrero. Yeah. He beat Robert Guerrero. He beat – I mean, he was to the nails with Gamboa. Went over to Puerto Rico, dismantled Lopez. I mean, his resume is extensive. I remember the same thing. I remember it was like, oh, Lomachenko, he's done. He's wiped off the earth. There's no reason to bring up his name. And I'm like, man, you lose to a guy like that, and that's the end of the road for you? I mean, that's really where boxing and fans are always at. You know, they think that one blemish is completely it, that's the antidote of being written off the map of boxing, the landscape of boxing. That's really not. I mean, our best fights, and we're talking about this because we do a show that's called, right now that we're doing, it's called Beer Boxing Quarantine. And I was mentioning that if you really think about all the great fights the fights that have made it to Fight of the Year, or you know, or given you produced some of the best leather being thrown in on television, have all been from guys that don't have blemished records. They don't have anything to lose anymore. You know, that pressure of keeping that O, when it's gone, we tend to see these guys perform 3 times, 4 times better in the ring.
Yeah, it's, now that I think about it, you never seen a guy who was undefeated be like in a Fight of the Year, really, to be honest, huh? I'm trying to think, like, over the years.
I'm trying to think of one right now. I mean, except, well, I mean...
like Canelo Golovkin, but that wasn't the Fight of the Year for me, you know?
Right.
Well, no, Canelo had the one loss to Floyd, so that,
exactly.
That's out. You know, yeah, I can't really think of anything, you know? That's a good point, and I think... fans in general need to get over the notion of a fighter's garbage if they have a loss. And you know who's the best example of that? At present, Julian Williams. Mm. Everybody wrote him off after that knockout that he had to Charlo.
Right.
People said he was done, he was finished, that he wouldn't amount to anything anymore, and then he ends up winning the titles. Yeah, he loses them again, but that just goes to show you, like, hey, like, this guy has already proved everybody wrong. Any given night, anybody could lose. That's how it is in any sport. In any sport, any given night, when you're facing the top competition, any given night, you can lose. It all amounts to the little mistakes. You know, everybody's on the same level when you're at that elite level. And it's just one little slip of can end up costing you a fight. And in the general sports world, you know, it's the little mess-ups that end up going to your loss. Why do you think the NBA, the finals, is... with 7 games, you know,
right.
Like I said, because they're all on the same level.
Exactly. And speaking about that, like Williams, I mean, the guy that we're going to be talking about next is a guy that had practically 3 different careers in his box, in his whole boxing resume. Marco Antonio Barrera. I mean, here's a guy, starts off as a bantamweight, was just mowing through guys, moves up to featherweight, loses to, you know, Pacquiao, and, you know, loses to Eric Morales, but then comes back and beats Hamed. I mean, it just shows you, any given night, and any fighter that digs deep and really honestly decides to kind of break themselves apart and then rebuild themselves can do a whole lot in boxing. I mean, I always find it kind of puzzling that how fight fans... they always forget that what we really truly love about the sport is this backstory. That's what sucks us in to sitting down and watching these guys and being emotional, going through this roller coaster of rounds with the guy you're rooting for. It's really because of their story and their fight style and what they've been through and what they've accomplished or what they're hoping to accomplish in the sport. You know, I mean, it's just the beauty of any combat sport.
No, very true. That's what sucks you in, because you could relate to that struggle, because a lot of these guys, you know, come from disadvantaged backgrounds or very hard upbringings, and you feel for them because, you know, we all want to see somebody who comes from a very poor economic and social background go and move up and become successful. I think that's everybody's dream is to become successful to a point where they don't have to struggle anymore. And that's one of, I think, the greatest things about boxing is you see stories of these guys that come from nothing, that they're dirt poor, eating out of trash cans, homeless at times, living in the gyms, and,
right.
And they reach success. And we know how much work is put into that. And it serves as a lesson in life, like, not to give up, that you can overcome that. Just because you're born into poverty, it's not a death sentence for you. You could fight your way out, because at the end of the day, life is a constant struggle against obstacles that come our way, you know. And it's, boxing is the closest example there is to life, to be honest, you know, when you look at the daily struggles that these guys go through. And you see it also that life's not guaranteed. Just like in boxing, life is not guaranteed, you know. We don't ever want to see that. But, you know, it's the same thing, man. There's a lot of parallels there.
He finished off his career with 67 wins, 7 losses, and 44 KOs. You know, I remember meeting Antonio, Marco Antonio in Reno right after an event. He was sitting down with his family. I got to tell you, I don't know, I would like to ask you if there was ever a fighter in either world, in the MMA or boxing, where you kind of lost, you lost every thought that you wanted to ask him. You just went blank. Because I was a huge fan of Antonio, of Marco Antonio. And I remember walking up to him, and he was so generous. He told me to sit down, and he started conversating. And I was literally, I only was able to get out a few words out of my mouth, man. And I went completely blank in speaking Spanish, too. I was like, okay, no, está bien. You know, he's all, and he goes, ¿quieres algo para comer? I'm like, no, sí.
I'm sure there has been a few times where, like, I have gone blank. I'm trying to remember now, like, with who. I'm pretty sure it probably would have happened earlier when I was doing it. I want to say I got kind of like that with Conor McGregor when I interviewed him for his tour for the fight with Floyd. I don't know, because all of a sudden he was right there, and I was just kind of like, taken aback, like, oh shit, there he is.
You didn't go, who the fuck is this?
Yeah, probably. Might have been the man, I'm trying to think. Might have happened to me with Oscar. I'm starting to get, like, my, you know, doing this for so long, like,
right,
for very foggy memories at times. But I think, yeah, with Oscar, I kind of got like that, because I was a big, big Oscar De La Hoya fan growing up. You know, Barrera, I love talking to Barrera. Barrera's so nice, man. And he's one of the few fighters that I've heard that you could be a fan of, and then you end up being friends with them. I've heard a lot of stories of fans right. that ended up being friends with Barrera, and Barrera staying in contact with them.
Oh, really nice guy, man. Really nice guy. Let's see how he stacks up to Juan Francisco Estrada. 40 wins, 3 losses, 27 knockouts. What do you think, man, if they would have faced each other in this time, what do you think would have edged out?
You know, it's tough, because I like to say that Barrera's best weight was at featherweight, no?
Yeah, I would say that too. Because Barrera was cut, like I said, he was a guy that went out. He was, you know, a mowing machine. You know, he went out there whirlwind, but he put a lot of pressure. And his jab was there, but it wasn't the jab that we saw as a featherweight. It just wasn't there. He didn't need it as a bantamweight.
I think he like grew into his body when he started going up those weight classes.
Right.
To featherweight and above. Especially, I think it started with the Prince Nassim fight, and then after that with the fights that he had with everybody else. At a lighter weight, I don't know. You know, you might make the argument that Estrada is better at the lighter weights, you know, and that's the big thing with that argument, that those lighter weights, featherweight and below, weren't Barrera, to me at least, wasn't Barrera's best weight, even though he had already accomplished a lot. And I think he did win a super bantamweight title, and he had two fights with Junior Jones, I believe. Like I said, my memory's really fine.
Right. Yeah, he got stopped with Junior Jones, and that was at Bantam. Well, you know, I think the reason why he was so dominant, if I remember correctly, was because he was draining himself to make bantamweight. That's why they decided to make that move to featherweight. If my memory serves me right, and guys, you can let me know in the chat room. D-Style just commented, Barrera beats Estrada 12 rounds at decision. Possibly so. But I think that Estrada, I'm tending to lean with you, Marcos, just because what I've seen with Estrada, he does well under pressure. I mean, he fought Gonzalez. I mean, we've seen what he can do with guys that are coming forward and putting a lot of pressure, which would be Barrera style at bantamweight. Come forward, put a lot of pressure, throw a lot of punches, kind of get you out of your rhythm, and that's what he would catch you. And a lot of the guys that he did face at bantamweight were smaller guys. That's why he looked like a monster. Going in the featherweight division, I think that's when he grew into his body, and he started to, that's when he started to realize, I need to develop I need to just pull the bag of tricks that I have of my real boxing skills to hold up with these bigger guys. They're now draining themselves to make featherweight.
Yeah, I think the other thing with Gallo is Gallo was a lot more lighter on his feet than Barrera. A little bit slicker as well, where Gallo does have the ability to box and move, get in and out. More versatile on his feet than Barrera would have been, even though Barrera was just so solid fundamentally. But, you know, the big point on this is, like we had mentioned, I don't think Barrera really came into his own and become the great fighter that he ended up becoming up until he made that move up, because of what you mentioned. You know, these weight cuts affect guys big time, you know. And we're seeing Gallo right now. That's his weight, you know. That's right. His best optimum fighting weight. That's where he performs the best. And Barrera, you can make an argument that he didn't necessarily perform the best when he was at his lighter weights, that he performed the best when he was at featherweight and above.
Now we move down to ringside, the Rat King, who has got a compelling record of 47-5 losses, 41 KOs, 1 draw. This, to me, man, would be fight of the year, Marcos. I think that these guys would complement each other a whole lot at bantamweight. I don't even think this, if they had faced each other, I don't think it goes past 6 rounds, to tell you the truth.
Ah, man, that would have been a tough fight. That would have very, very tough, just because of Runga-Sai's power. Even though I want to say that Barrera would have won.
I'm not sure, man. I'm
thinking, I just keep thinking if Runga-Sai would have clocked him, Barrera would have gone down, you know? It would have been tough. You know, higher weight, different story. But at that weight, I want to say Barrera, just because.
Well, I look at the way Barrera, how aggressive he was at bantamweight. That I tend to think that he's going to walk in to a big punch that Ringside is going to throw. And I think that's what's going to hurt him. He gets clipped.
Because I look at Roman, the first fight that he had with Ringside, you know, he was coming forward throwing a lot of punches.
Right.
Even though Ringside ended up winning that fight, I think a majority of boxing fans felt that Roman won that fight. It could have been a fight similar to that one, the first Roman-Ringside fight. Even though I think Roman throws more punches than Barrera, but Barrera, man, it just reminds you how good Roman was.
Yep.
It's prime, because he was just so complete. I want to say that Roman had just as good timing as Barrera in a lot of these exchanges. Yeah, it would have been a tough one, man. It could have been a fight where if Barrera could withstand the power of Ringside and be able to take the punch as well, he would have ended up winning wide on the scorecards. Competitive. It would have been very competitive. I see him getting a majority decision, but a very close majority decision.
You know, Junior Jones, if anything, he exposed that Barrera was acceptable to a right hand. Didn't see it, couldn't see it, and couldn't defend against it, even in both fights when they had faced each other. I would really have to lean with the Rat King. I think he takes it. Yep, I think he takes it.
My only thing is that he doesn't throw a lot, you know?
Right.
That's my only thing.
But he's so heavy-handed, you know? And I think with Barrera's style at that time, that Barrera's stubbornness, he showed it with Junior Jones, poison, that he didn't know how to take a step back in box. He tried to get his every time he got hurt. He tried to return the favor, and that's what got him in trouble every time.
That's what led to such great fights with him. But, that's not necessarily the smartest thing to do as a fighter. If you hit me, I'm going to try to hit you back. It makes sense. That's like a natural instinct. You hit me, I'm going to try to hit you back. But, you know, in boxing, it's a little bit different, because you try to get that punch back, and you might end up getting cracked. So, now, you bring a good point. You bring a good point. You know, Ringside is not the fastest guy. But he does land those punches. But who's to say that Ringside wouldn't have tried to fight him orthodox, and he would have been completely outclassed, like how he fought Gallo in that second fight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Now we move on to Roman Gonzalez, 49 wins, 2 losses, 41 KOs, complete fighter. God, did he look great in his last fight? I thought it was phenomenal to see him just come back into the limelight and get the respect that he's well overdue for him. Fortunately, we're getting, I don't know if we're getting the tail end of him. I was talking to Marcos Caballero, who's his trainer now, he's been with him for 2 years. I remember saying that, like, oh man, you know, even though it's late in his career, and I remember him getting like kind of disgruntled over the phone. He was like, what do you mean? No. He's the same guy. He needed rest. He needed to just kind of get himself back together. Trust me, he's not done with his career. He's got at least 3 or 4 more fights left in him, you know. And I know they're pressing hard for the Juan Francisco Estrada fight, you know, and they think strong. They feel strongly that that's another winnable fight for them again because they had faced each other the first time. But I think it was just a different time. Where Juan Francisco was at in his career. I think it makes it a completely different match if they do get a chance to step in again and face each other. But against Barrera, I got to tell you, this one here is Barrera Bantamweight, again, a pressure fighter coming forward. I think it suits Roman Gonzalez all the way.
Yeah, I would have favored Roman in that fight at that weight. Because I think any higher weight would have been Barrera, but I think as we've seen, it depends. You know, what version? Man, this is all dependent on weight classes, really. You know,
right?
Because okay, Roman's best weight, in your opinion, what was it? Was it? I want to say 112. I think, you know, because 115. It showed, you know, when
Roman showed at these heavier weights right now. Let's just this bantamweight 115. So ringside, you saw the size affect him. It was too much for him. So I tend to think that Marcos Antonio Barrera would probably be too big for Roman at this division too. And the style that he fought as a bantamweight, I think that he busses up Roman, but not knock him out. I think it's just going to be a very close fight because I think what will happen is Roman will adjust to what Barrera's doing and then probably take over in those late rounds. But
it's a tough one because there's so many. Here's the thing, like, we're basing it on Roman now, what he looks like now in the context of that he got knocked out a few fights ago and he hasn't. We haven't seen a lot of him since that fight, so it's hard. And the other thing is, him at this weight, I've heard journalists from Nicaragua say that this is not the best weight for Roman, that he's too small for this weight. You know, that the 112 was a better weight for him, and that's really was his weight. His marquee performances came from that weight, so... I agree. You know, you could see that Barrera is the bigger guy, and Roman's punches wouldn't have backed off Barrera as much as, say, like someone like Rungvisai, who probably would have thought twice about going and throwing punches because of his power.
Right.
It would have been a great fight, but could have been a split decision for Barrera, I think, based on that.
Yeah, I think so too. Like I said, I think it all depends on the judges on that night, but I think that the size is going to be a major difference for Roman to keep off Barrera. And the whirlwind that he was as a bantamweight, it just spells all bad for Roman. I think Roman would adjust in the later rounds if he doesn't get hurt and if he's not busted up too much because, you know, Marcos wasn't like he wasn't a world beater. I mean, he wasn't a one-punch knockout artist. He was a guy that had a really he outlasted you.
Yeah, no, the volume.
Exactly.
It wouldn't be one punch. It would be 3 or 4 that would end up over a period of time that would end up taking its toll on you, you know, because... Obviously, you're fighting for 12 rounds, and he knew that. He's a smart guy. He's
right.
One of the smartest guys that I've ever fought, you know? And that's the beauty of it, to come to the realization, like, hey, I have 12 rounds to work with. I'm going to pick which punches that are going to they're gonna pick you apart. And little by little, you're going to break down. You know, that's what the beauty of this sport is as well, that not every punch has to be a power punch, you know?
Exactly.
You could touch, throw a hard one in there. You know, make your rhythm so, like, offbeat that guys don't know what to expect when you're throwing at it. And, yeah, it's a little intricacies like that that I love boxing when, like, you really start breaking it down. Like, and it's such a, like, intricate sport with, like, little intricacies that I get lost in them sometimes, man. And there's so much to learn when you're going over tape and also when you're talking to trainers and listening to what they're saying as well.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Well, you know, like I said, I'm not so big on fantasy fights, but I tell you what, I had a blast doing this. You know, it really made me open up the vault in my brain to remember the style of the past fighters, the past greats, and to really kind of just kind of break down and analyze these guys that are in the division. You know, when they say these fighters nowadays can't match up to the guys from the 80s and 90s, man, bro, when you really sit there and think about it and you really break down their styles, they absolutely can. Absolutely can. You know,
some of them can. Some of them obviously couldn't. Right. There's a lot of guys that were special back in the 80s and 90s. But I think, you know, the main point that people forget it is that the science is so much better now in terms of training and nutrition. And these athletes are just better athletes than they were back in the 80s and 90s. That
better drugs.
Unfortunately,
that's another story, but yeah.
Yeah, but you would think that any gap in technique or any gap in talent,
right,
could be curbed a little bit or at least made even or make yourself competitive because of the training methods and the nutrition that's available today.
Absolutely, man. Well, Marcus, I want to thank you, bro, for coming on for the show, first episode for us for Stack, the Stack Up Show, man. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun. Take care, and I hope to speak to you and have you once on again on the show with us, bro.
Oh, we'd love to, man. It was a good chat, as always. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right, brother. Talk to you guys soon. Everybody, don't forget to subscribe and hit the like button and hit that little bell so you're notified when we go live. And I appreciate everybody that comes through. Don't forget, every Monday, we should be back on live on Leaving the Ring.